High desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever it may be, wherever you are in all 25 time zones covered by this program, like a blanket, a nice, warm, informative blanket called Midnight in the Desert. My name is Art Bell, and my pleasure to be here with you tonight. Linda Moulton Howe up in a bit. A lot of really hot stuff, too. A lot going on right now. So, two rules for the show, two rules only, and that is no bad language. Don't need it. Doesn't make a point. Well, I guess it does, but we don't need it. One call per show. So, let's look very quickly at a little bit of news that does seem to be out there. This is pretty interesting. U.S. satellites have looked carefully now at the explosion. And I think that's the right word of the Russian airplane, passenger airplane, just before it went down. And we have seen, an explosion or a very large heat signature prior to it burning up now. This could be something else, but I'm not convinced we're ever going to find out. I mean, it's in the hands of countries that, frankly, I don't think are going to tell us. ISIS is taking the credit for bringing this plane down. Rarely do they claim credit for something they actually haven't done, so I'm inclined to think I bet that's it, but we'll have to wait and see. Here's an interesting story. Americans are hot, but not too bothered by global warming. Most Americans know and can see the climate is changing, but they're just not worried about it. No worry. I personally think the time to worry for most Americans is going to be as water is lapping at their ankles. And they'll look down and go, oh, global warming. Of course, by then, New York will be underwater. Miami will be underwater. I wonder if L.A. would be underwater. Probably. Santa Barbara, for sure. A lot of our big major cities, but, you know, until it's lapping right at their ankles, I don't think that the American people are going to notice. We're not going to do anything about it in time, I am convinced. Gigantic earthworks in Kazakhstan that are practically invisible from the ground. This comes from theanomalous.com. It seems the earthworks seen from space are reminiscent of Peru's Nazca lines, but more numerous, more varied in shape and size. These structures are not geoglyphs like the Nazca lines, but unlike the Nazca lines, these formations serve some sort of function rather than display artwork. Some researchers believe. Others argue, of course. We can really only guess at what may have come before us, other than really, really, really hard news, you know, about what's dug up from the ground. And even then. Oh, and on artbell.com, I think this is a major news story, actually. NASA is confirming that the impossible EM drive thruster actually works. This is very exciting. Electromagnetic drive that actually works. Something that could take us to the stars. Now, what speed ultimately? I don't know. But if you continue, once you get away from Earth and our influence, and you begin to thrust, no matter how little it is, I don't really want to say how little, but even if it's fairly small, you will eventually get to very, very great speeds if you keep thrusting. Right? So this is potentially earth-shaking news. I think that's the way to put it. And there's actually a picture of the EM drive that NASA is saying, my goodness, it works. Now, they're not sure how. They're just sure that they've tested and it works. I'd say that's pretty big news. As, of course, was my favorite star, the story that I broke now so long ago on KIC 8462852, and it still hasn't been named. We ought to call it something. Why don't we call it Tabitha? Don't you think that might be appropriate? Tabitha, the star. Anyway, I'm sure tonight's guest is going to have some fair bit to share with us about all this. Linda Moulton Howe is a graduate of Stanford University with a master's degree in communications. She devoted her documentary, film, television, radio, and writing and reporting career to productions concerning science, medicine, and the environment. That'll keep you busy. Ms. Howe has received local, national, and international awards, including 3 regional Emmys, a national Emmy nomination for the Station Peabody Award for Medical Programming. Really? Linda's documentaries have included A Strange Harvest and Strange Harvests in 1993, which explored the worldwide animal mutilation mystery. Tonight she will talk to us about many things, but I suspect perhaps out front will be the Kepler discovery. And it's just awesome. What can I tell you about it? As you know, we broke this story very, very early. Others, I don't know, ignored it. I'm not sure what to say about that, but they did. And it's reasonably the biggest story of our lifetimes. Now, it may turn out to be nothing, or, as Michio Kaku said, the biggest story in 500 years. I still don't know how he chose that 500-year mark, because I think no matter how far back you go, well, until you get to 2,000 years plus, right, there could be no bigger story, could there, than we're not alone? There are others out there. There are others who, in fact, may be not just 1,500 light-years ahead, roughly, but that plus whatever they were when they obscured their sun with an energy-gathering device, if that's what it is, a Dyson sphere. Anyway, Linda will have a lot to say about this and interviewed some of the principals involved in this as well. I think, the more I think about it, Tabitha would be a great name. Tabitha the Star. I'm going to think that one over, but I kind of like it. Linda Howe coming up in just a moment. Stay right where you are.
Doesn't screen calls. We trust you, but remember, the NSA. Well, you know, to call the show, please dial 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
Well, okay. So here is Linda Moulton Howe, probably coming to us from New Mexico, right?
Yeah, Albuquerque.
Albuquerque, that's right. All right. You know, when I dial you, Linda, I'm calling you in Albuquerque through Roswell.
The cushion shot of history.
Yeah. I've got a Roswell phone line. It was one of those things, why not? What the hell?
Yeah.
I have a Roswell
phone. A little magic to our connection.
That's right. All right.
One other piece of magic is you're awfully close to the name of the star that Professor Jason Wright, the astronomer at Penn State, who's a good friend of Professor Tabitha Boyajian, who did the 14-page, we'll call it the paper in the Royal Astronomical Society that set all this off in September. He calls the star KIC 8462852 Tabby's star, and because he calls her Tabby.
I was going to say Tabby. I had a feeling Tabby would be just perfect, actually.
Yeah, and it should be named after her. She is the one who has led all of this work the last 4 years. She helped organize the Planet Hunters project, and it is so interesting that it is the civilians working in the Planet Hunters project trying to wade their way through 150,000 stars in the Milky Way galaxy studied by the Kepler Space Telescope, and it was getting everybody with computers all over the place to try to look at these various dimmings and brightenings in stars looking for, they thought, like a planet or planets that would be orbiting stars, because we've been on a big planet hunting mission for a long time. And this is why this is all extremely exciting, that the bottom line is after they had gone past 100,000 stars, and some reports are that Kepler has actually looked at 150,000 stars through Planet Hunters, that this is singular art. This is unique. This is the one star in all of these stars in which the brightening and the dimming is not symmetric, and this is really important. If you look at what we have been doing for the last decade with looking at what planets at various light years away, it would dim and brighten around stars looking for planets. The planet comes around the star depending upon how big it is, and there is sort of a bell-shaped curve. The dimming will rise. There will be about a max of 1% dimming, and then as the planet goes on around the star, it gets brighter, and it's what is called symmetrical dimming and brightening.
Mm-hmm.
Those are normal planets, and take that number, 1%. 1% is the average dimming. Well, what happened 2 years ago is that Tabitha Boyajian and Planet Hunters, they got up to 15% dimming and brightening on this KIC 846. We'll call it tonight. Let's call it Tabby's star.
Let's.
Yeah, and so 15% after 2 years of Kepler's looking, that broke everybody's record.
Did the did the mainstream get it wrong? Let me tell you, Linda, how it broke. It broke first in very low-level internet sites, but actually fairly trustworthy internet sites. I found it at that point, and I went, oh, my God, this is a giant story, and got it on the air right away. It took about two days after that, it began to hit the mainstream press. And, in a lot of the mainstream press, for example, the Washington Post, they suggest it has dimmed at times by as much as 22%. Is that inaccurate?
Well, that's what I was coming to.
Okay.
I'm looking at Tabitha's paper right now, and she's got a summary of all of the varying dimmings and brightening experiences, and when, after 4 years, it went to 22%, that is the most. And that is, as Professor Wright, and he comes into this, Jason Thomas Wright, at Penn State, not Yale. Tabitha is at Yale University, but he's a colleague, and there are many people who have been helping on this project. He came into this because when you get the kind of brightening that went up and down, as he said, they've had dozens of these episodes, some at 10%, some at 7%, some at 5%, the 22%, 15%. What this means, when you add it to the fact that they are not getting symmetric dimming and brightening, this is erratic, this is multiple, and that means, from their point of view, that there have to be multiple objects that are huge, gigantic, and that they are many. There was one paper that I read called it a mess of objects. And it is that which astronomically is of great, I would say, great impact on all of this. And then it was the UK newspaper, the Mail, that took it to that level of alien megastructures. And that is when the megastructure issue came up. I think that's what they had all been talking about privately behind the scenes anyway. They reached out to SETI and Greenbank. But when it was sort of blasted out by the UK papers as, could there be alien megastructures around this star, that's when the astronomers want to pull back and go into the shadows because they're not prepared to say. Well, this leads again to my getting in touch with Professor Jason Wright because...
All right, one more question, Linda. Jason Wright, in here, in the Washington Post, it quotes Jason Wright. It says, to Wright, it looked like the kind of star he and his colleagues had been waiting for. If none of the ordinary reasons for the star's flux quite seemed to fit, perhaps an ordinary one was in order, aliens. And it occurred to me at that moment that both Tabitha and especially Wright would think long and hard, really long and hard about their careers, their lives, their wives, their families, their future, before they would ever utter such a word.
Well, now you come to why they're taking this so seriously, and there's a bunch of reasons. And what Professor Wright agreed to do for Tabitha and this effort was to put together a protocol of like 10 things that if you said, if this were a huge structure out around this star and that it fit into the category of, say, the hypothetical Dyson sphere that Freeman Dyson suggested as far back as 1960, that's when he wrote up a paper. It was called Search for Artificial Stellar Sources of Infrared Radiation. It was published in the most prestigious journal of all science. And it was Dyson's concept that if you have an advanced civilization, Michio Kaku has taken Dyson's work and has taken the Nikolai Kardashev's work also about type 1, 2, and 3 civilizations based on their energy usage and how they would get that energy. And so when Dyson suggested in a kind of thought experiment that he wrote up for science that all technological civilizations constantly increase their demand for energy, and so he concluded that if a human civilization expanded, that the energy that we would have, that we would be needing, would come to a time when it would be the total energy output of our sun. And that's what led Freeman Dyson to come up with this idea that if you're advanced enough, and Michio would say it as like a civilization 2, which is on the Kardashev scale, a civilization that's capable of harnessing energy from a sun, then you, what he thought was you could, a civilization could, construct something either all around the sun or close to the sun in a structure that would capture the emissions from the star for energy use. And that is why when this story broke and the Daily Mail and others put in their headlines, are there megastructures around this star that has this strange dimming and brightening pattern? That's what the history is behind that headline. And the astronomers are reluctant to get into that category before they have eliminated everything else. And here we get to the huge work that Professor Wright has been doing, trying to come up with this protocol that would say, okay, if this were, let's say, that it is a circular planet or a circular object, if it comes in front a big mature KIC at 1480 or Tabby star, 1,480 light years away, it's going to have symmetrical dimming and brightening because it's circular. They have not seen that, as far as I understand in interviewing him, they have not seen that in a single one of these dimming episodes. It is erratic.
All right. Quick interjection here, and that is the following, Linda. If what you say is true, and as Kaku says, it would be a type 2 civilization, they've harnessed the power of a star, then let's think about this for a second. What we're observing is a type 2 civilization, if that's what it is, 1500, nearly 1500 years ago. Now, if you look at our technical progress from, oh, I don't know, the last 50 years, and you project 1500 years, just think what they might be doing now.
That's right. It's absolutely right. And you are making the point that everything that we look at in the universe is at a time that is far back in time,
yes,
from where we are right now.
Right.
And so how much further advanced, that is a very good question. But when you start kicking off, I'm not going to go through all 10, but just to give some examples of Professor Wright's contribution here, another would be if, let's say that this is a very large series of structures because there have been so many. Whatever it is taking weeks. Stress that. It's taking weeks for each of these blockings to dim and finally become bright again asymmetrically. So there's lots of stuff. It's extremely large. And he said in one of the pieces for me in an interview, if it's a large structure blocking a star, then it will block all wavelengths of light, all colors of light, the same at the same time. But if you have a planet can have an atmosphere, and the atmosphere will selectively block some colors and not others.
Uh-huh.
So you could make a distinction now as they try to get Green Bank to get on to this. And we now know that as of October 16th, with the contact from Tabitha and Professor Wright to SETI, SETI did move its Allen telescope array from its regular schedule
and
has been focusing on KIC. And here's another interesting thing. Instead of the narrowband scan that ATA has been on, they have now tuned to a scan for, and this is a quote from SETI, transmissions that would produce excess power over a range of wavelengths, close quote.
I'm sorry, Lynn, I'm laughing because I had Seth on. Seth was at home with pneumonia, and I called him about this story, and he said, oh my God. And I talked to him the next day. He said, we've ordered everything to start looking at it. And I said, Seth, listen to me. If they're using that kind of power, there is bound to be gigantic electromagnetic emissions. So you might not get a discrete signal, but what you might get is a general noise level increase as you come on tabby.
Well, that may be true, but now remember, they're trying to separate the wheat from the chaff here.
I know.
And they're going through this list of all possible things natural, which, between you and me and the other astronomers, the idea that there would be a horde of comets that would be rotating this star causing this kind of effect. I think that just on the size level alone, that if you have things that are taking weeks to pass in dimness and brightness,
mm-hmm,
that's not a group of comets. And I can't say that there's proof, but I'm trying to say they started off ticking off the natural things. Now, if you come back to this issue of the light that is coming from that sun, and depending upon what these structures are, and we can look at it with the Allen array, and they're even adding now a new kind of hardware that's going to increase the sensitivity,
mm-hmm,
of the Allen array by a factor of 2, and their goal is to up the odds that SETI could detect an alien signal if there was one being transmitted. And when I say that, that has been the historic search of SETI to look for the
I know.
Okay. We're in a very different category when it comes to the issues of the brightening and the dimming and these structures. So now, if we turn all of these arrays and hopefully get Green Bank on this in the next 3 or 4 or 5 months, that they will look at all the wavelengths, and as Professor Wright said to me, one thing that could be quite startling is if these, what now are dimming, brightening, block out all color frequencies when they look at it with a spectrograph.
Okay, that's new to me.
yeah, this is one of the things they're going to try. They want to see. And if it is anything that has any translucent, transparent, an atmosphere, that will there will be some wavelengths that will get through and not. Now let's go to dust, because one of the big hypotheses is that it could be some weird form of clumps of dust going around there. This is definitely one of the things that they're going to be trying to eliminate this way. Dust lets red wavelength through. Dust blocks blue. So if they start analyzing what are they getting between red and blue, would it confirm or not that these could be dust clumps? Well, I just read that right now SETI is saying that they have no confirmation of dust at Tabby Star at all.
Wow.
Now, if that holds up, that is a big deal.
Linda, hold it right there. Hold it right there. Yeah, that's a big deal, all right. The whole thing is a big deal. And a lot of other people out there ought to realize how big a deal this potentially could be. I'm Art Bell. Midnight in the desert, roaring in the nighttime. Wonder what Cody would have thought of the squatty. I swear. Sometimes. Close your mouth, Arthur.
Take a walk on the wild side of midnight. From the Kingdom of Nye, this is Midnight in the Desert with Art Bell. Please call the show at 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
All right, I never do this, so I'm going to do it very quickly. I assume here I'm preaching to the choir, so I don't hit you with endless advertisements for our time traveler group, but let me go ahead and mention it, because surely there are some of you out there who don't know that we have archives of every show we've done on Midnight in the Desert. And when you're a member, yeah, it's a join thing, right? When you're a member, you can go back. I think we've got like 75 to 80 shows in the tank now. You can go back and listen to any show you want anytime. It's pretty darn cool, you know, the RSS feed. So that plus access to the wormhole. The wormhole is a strange name for something where you can go and type a message to me and get it to me during the show. Now, my guest is Linda Moulton Howe. We are talking about what could be the biggest story of our lifetimes, or perhaps nothing at all, but she's bringing new information to the table with respect to the possibility of dust, and they're going to be able to rule it in or rule it out, and thus far out. What I was saying earlier was, if it is, if it's an alien civilization that has harnessed a sun, then they're using immense amounts of power for whatever, we can't probably even imagine what it would be, but a gigantic electromagnetic signature is probable. So as I mentioned to Seth at SETI, even a general noise hike, as in a lot of electromagnetic energy is being used by an entire civilization, would indicate something that would up it a notch in likelihood. And he said yes. So it's an immensely interesting story. And by the way, Linda, I heard Jupiter in front of this star would dim at about 1%, right?
That's right. The planet world is about 1%, and with KIC, Tabby's star, they've been to 22% dimming. And when before the break, I was talking about this whole issue, could they confirm dust clots or not? And right now, the latest info is that they have not been able to confirm dust. And I asked Professor Wright at Penn State, what if it is in dust and you don't see that evidence? Then what? And he said, this is a quote, Well, that's a great clue, because if it's not dust, then that really narrows it down to a large mass of objects, and I don't know. We're going to have to go to the theorists and say, quote, how do you block starlight without seeing signatures of dust, close quote. And that will be a real mystery that will be hard to figure out. But the eureka moment that we found aliens, I don't know how to do that except for the radio waves, and that's where Green Bank will come in and SETI will come in. And what another very interesting quote was from Professor Wright about this that adds to the fact they haven't confirmed dust. The way that Tabby's star gets dimmer is not the way it gets bright, and in fact it gets dimmer and then it looks like it's going to get brighter again, and then it gets dimmer again and even dimmer. It is random. That suggests that whatever is blocking the star's light has a very complex structure. So it is something the size of a star, perhaps, itself, that is doing the blocking. But it's not a circle or a sphere. It is something with a complex shape, and there's a lot of them, because we see dozens of times the star gets dimmer. And each one of those is a separate object passing between us and the star. And remember, it's not symmetrical. It is erratic. And that leads to one of the more important quotes in just the last 2 weeks. And this came from that senior scientist, Gerald Harp, at SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute in Mountain View, California. This is his quote. We either caught something shortly after an event, like two planets crashing together, or we have alien intelligence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and if dust isn't in the equation yet, that would seem to eliminate two planets crashing together. And this is really becoming so interesting because, as you and I were talking earlier, if this turns out that once they get Green Bank on it and the Allen Array, and they've eliminated all of the natural possibilities, and this dimming, erratic dimming, that's multiple structures of something, they keep getting more and more data. Art, this would be the discovery of other intelligence in the universe in our lifetimes, and this is an enormous deal.
It is. It's what we've all been waiting for. I know it's what I've been waiting for, Linda. And I say a silent little prayer, I think, that it is that. But, you know, once we know it is that, boy, I'll tell you, there's a lot of other questions and things that are to be considered. If they are that far ahead of us, or if they were at, 1,480 years ago, that far ahead of us, what are they doing with their spare time now?
And you just have to pray that advanced intelligence is not looking to take fly squatters to lower life, and that they are advanced both in compassion and otherwise. But that's not a given either. When you look back over the last 12 months, Elon Musk from Tesla, Bill Gates from Microsoft, and Hawking, the physicist in England, all three independently warned that one of the most dangerous things that we might have been doing on Earth was sending out the SETI signals into space without knowing what was on the receiving end. I'm not saying that to be scary. I'm just saying that those three minds in the last 12 months have been warning that maybe there is a possibility that in this big universe that there might be things out there that might be dangerous.
Well, I know we did send a high-powered signal from Puerto Rico, but it was a very short duration thing, actually aimed at gaining somebody's attention like this. And I, too, am a little concerned about who might receive it and what their temperament might be when they do.
Well, remember the two crop formations. One, the year of August, right before 9/11, the horror, and the next year, almost to the day in August, The first one was the binary code set right down in the front doors of the Chilbolton Observatory.
Yes.
His work had been in contacting and listening to radio signals from stars. That's what it did. And this huge binary code is set down right in front of the front doors. And it was basically about if you took the Sagan Drake gold plaque with information about our DNA, the height of a human,
yes,
the third planet in the star system of nine, all of the stuff that you've seen in photographs, and you sent that out and you got an answer back. And the answer came in August of 2001. It went down line by line, quite literally, everything that Sagan and Drake sent out from Arecibo was in the binary code in that wheat in front of the Chilbolton Observatory. But the differences were where we gave the nucleotides for our double helix DNA, the return answer in the wheat was a completely different, it appeared to be three stranded DNA.
Linda, yeah, before this conversation continues, was that particular crop circle validated in the ways that we validate crop circles, you know, truth, yeah, from baloney?
Oh, yeah. One of the first people in there was Charles Mallett. He is stringent and sharp about anything having to do with what hoaxers do versus this phenomena.
Right.
And this was, without doubt, to him and to the rest of us, this was an extraordinary pattern. And remember, it was I believe it was 5 days before the binary code came down literally at the front door of the Chilbolton Observatory, as if you didn't see what we put out in the wheat 5 days ago. That was the first strange face. It was sort of humanoid, and no one later could believe that this face had been out, and the people working at Chilbolton Observatory had noticed a, quote, shadow, close quote, out in the wheat that just goes right along the border of the observatory to this day. And they had seen this shadow, and there wasn't a single person who called any authorities or went out into the wheat field. It took 5 days for a pilot to fly over and communicate to authorities that got to the observatory. Look, I'm looking at a face out of here in this wheat.
Yeah.
And that was, so that was almost a simultaneous discovery of the face at the time of the binary, but we know the face was there before. The face was very unique. It was not exactly human. It definitely was not the gray that came the next year, and this is what I'm leading to. So we get this binary code that is answering line by line the Sagan, what they sent out in, 74,
yeah,
in December 74. Of 1974.
And you're saying it was exactly the same, except the DNA was three-stranded in...
Every line was different. In other words, if you took the Sagan-Drake signal that was sent out December 1974,
right.
And you took line by line, the binary code that came in front of Chilbolton was line by line, apparently the same information, just exactly like an answer, line by line, but quite different. And when it got down to the solar system where we had nine planets and the sun, and Sagan and Drake raised the third planet from the sun because that was Earth, and they put the raised planet right up underneath the feet of the little humanoid that they put in the signal, and they showed in our binary code that two arms, two legs, the bisymmetry of the humanoid was 6 feet. They showed that in binary code. Well, in this one, it was not nine planets. The fourth circle in this much bigger solar system was raised, the fourth, and it had four little dots around it. And I showed that to an astronomer from Yale, Cornell. It was Cornell University. And his first reaction, without knowing that it was a crop circle, he said, that might be an interesting astronomical way to communicate a planet that had four moons. Never thought about that before, right? So that is in there. And the character where we, where Drake and Sagan had a human-looking figure that said 6 feet, this was a large-headed, short, extremely short, compared to the six-foot human, with information that the binary code translation was never quite entirely clear. But here is the subtlety and what has always stunned those of us who started going to England back in 92, like I did. In Chilbolton, on the bottom line, where Sagan and Drake had put in a glyph representing the Arecibo radar telescope, and it looked like a dish in what we sent out in December 1974. Mm-hmm. In what would be then the sender of the information that got into the Chilbolton wheat, it was identical to a crop formation the August before 2001 at Chilbolton. And so it meant that we were dealing with an intelligence that put down in front of Chilbolton's front doors in 2000 the exact glyph that went into the sender category the next year in 2001, August. These dates were almost all the same August 14th dates. 2000, then 2001 came binary code in the head. And then the next year in August of 2001 was the, let's see, make sure I'm doing this right, 2001, the binary came before 9/11, and 2002 is the next year the formation moved a few miles to the east, and it was called Crabwood near Winchester, and this was the huge gray in a wheat field holding a big, like a disc. It was circular binary code, and it was that binary code that was translated by people all over the world about we oppose deception. There are evil forces at work. The time is growing short, but there is still time for things to be good. And that is a third. It was like three acts. They showed the transmitter in front of Chilbolton one August, followed by the binary code in the strange head the next August, and the gray holding the disc with the binary code warning about deception the third.
All right, Lynn, I've got a quick question, and it is this. In police work, in investigation, when there has been a murder, particularly a horrific murder, I guess every murder is horrific in a way, they withhold a little bit of information so that as they go through sources and tips and all the rest of it, if they get somebody who confesses, they can actually then match that withheld information with, you know, something the person says and know they've got the real killer. And I wonder if any of the information we sent out, perhaps if just one little piece of it was withheld. Of course, we can't really know that, but it would have been a wise move, don't you think?
Well, looking back now, I guess so. But I think that when Drake and Sagan sent out that gold plaque in 1974, December, from Arecibo, that it was all in the context of positive, let's send this out and see what signals come back. Mm-hmm. While you and I and others know that going back to World War II, FDR, Truman, up to Eisenhower, they were consciously dealing with the presence of what they called celestial planforms, extraterrestrials, and that there was a decision during the Truman administration with Churchill to keep all information about extraterrestrials interacting with this planet from the public and media for at least two generations, that's 50 years, and from the close of World War II, 1945, you add 50 years to that, it would have been 1995 or the mid-90s that we should have learned everything that there was to learn, and instead the doors seem to slam even tighter. And today, I think you and I and people who have been riding this fucking horse for a long time, there is a sense that something is pushing open doors faster than anything, as if there's urgency now. We have to get this "We're Not Alone in the Universe" out there, perhaps for governments to finally level with us. As Lynn Buchanan, the remote viewer, told me 6 weeks ago, that he had remote viewed for the Defense Intelligence Agency when he was at Fort Meade with Pat Price, Mel Riley, and that group. And one of his assignments was to remote view friendly and unfriendly ETs and to put them in categories of psychic and not psychic. And he said it was quite fascinating, and that there were definitely friendlies that were psychic, friendlies that were not psychic, and unfriendlies that were psychic, and unfriendlies that were not, and that we are not in a completely benevolent, harmless universe. But he and so many people that I know have been in military or intel aspects of this, they really do, at the end of their work, they say the planet should know, everyone should know, because it is in knowledge that we're strengthened. We're vulnerable and we're weakened. We are kept in the dark. And so, Art, if you feel the same thing I do, it is as if now somebody is trying to push open more and more of this information all the time. And you led with that very important story about the electromagnetic drive being confirmed by NASA.
Oh, yeah.
It's like they're saying, we are getting ready to go to Mars.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Linda, hold tight. We're at a break. And we will be back. Linda Moulton Howe is here. I'm Art Bell. And by the way, I forgot to tell you, to be a time traveler, just go to artbell.com. You're supposed to tell people how to do it, right? So if you want to travel in time and get any show we've done, artbell.com is the way to do it. You'll be instructed as you get there. It's worth doing. We do good stuff. Now I stand here helplessly.
Clock strikes 12, and midnight in the desert is pounding packets your way on the Dark Matter Digital Network. To call the show, please direct your finger digits to dial 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
All right. Linda Moulton Howe is here, and I can't think of anything more important to talk about or exciting than what we're talking about right now. How these crop circles relate, if they relate, I don't know, but the intricacy of them is unquestionable. Apparently, the authenticity of them is thought to be very high. So, once again, here is Lynn Moulton Howe, and I understand you did an interview with Professor Wright. Now, would you like to play that interview, Linda, or do you feel that you've related already most of what he said?
Right. You know, on future shows, we should set it up so I'll organize around excerpts. But I think tonight that it's fun just kind of summarizing, and I can give you, though, the exact way we closed out my interview just a few weeks ago. I said, then this Tabby's star could finally be that which breaks open this question that has been there for centuries. Are we alone in the universe? Mm-hmm. We could discover advanced intelligence. It would be far away, but it could be a new reality, like revolutionary breakthrough from this star, that there are advanced intelligences harvesting energy from stars, just as science fiction and others have written about. And he said, Yes, that would be pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. That's why you work on SETI. That would be amazing if it happened. And so we should spend at least some resources trying to make it happen. And right now, I think it's encouraging that the Allen Array was immediately turned. They're trying to get Gene back, and they're doing all of this. And the American Association of Variable Star Observers, it's known as AAVSO, published an alert notice requesting amateurs and professional astronomers around the world to immediately begin observing KIC 846-2852. And all you have to do is go to the AAVSO website, and you just type in the KIC star number, and it's called Pick a Star, and then you create a chart of your own, and you can contribute to the study of this.
Okay, now I want to interject something, and then I want you to comment, Linda, and it is this. We talked about this with my listeners quite extensively, and I think that if they do announce or even confirm that something 1,480 light-years out is the real McCoy, and we are dealing with aliens, which could be the eventual result of this story, that the world will go on, everything will be fine. However, what I did was I asked a bunch of people who called in, many of them from the South, from the Bible Belt, Linda. This is a week ago. And here was what I asked them. I said, if aliens are found, and if aliens land, and they come down the ramp, and after learning how to communicate with them, we find that either, A, they don't worship a god, or B, that they just, you know, don't have the slightest idea what God is or even the concept, how would that affect you? And these many people were in the South, I'll grant you, in the Bible Belt, but they said such a revelation to them would shatter their faith.
And I guess my comment is that I started to say believe, and I don't want to use that overworked word. I'm going to say it this way, that if my relationship from being a child to where I am now and all the things where I should have been dead and something has saved me and all kinds of things that have given me a really strong sense that I have an ally in what I call the divine field, and it is outside of entropy, it is outside the matter worlds, but it is the origin for the matter worlds, and that from my point of view, every living anything has the pura vida from the divine field, and therefore, if something is advanced enough to get to a point that it has survived tribal warfare or whatever else would be the evolutionary curves of life evolving in this universe or even other universes, that if it gets to a point where it can build huge structures to harvest energy from a star, I just have to think that they would not be just immediately violent savages wanting to eliminate us or other life. And so it may be naive, but I really do think that advanced intelligence by the definition is not going to destroy other life willy-nilly.
Okay, all right. Well, that's perfectly reasonable to say, Linda, and I'm sure you're correct. I would hope they would socially advance as we, well, I don't know. As we are doing, I'm not sure we're doing it. We say we are, but I don't see proof of it yet. Maybe eventually we will. Either way, my point was, if they didn't know about God when they got here, even if we communicated with them and they didn't know about God, this would shatter the religious foundation and belief of really religious people. Now, if you're looking for reasons why it might not be announced, there's one in your lap.
Well, it's odd that anybody, whether it's from any religious box or those fundamentalists in the southeastern United States, that if they feel a closeness to a divine God and Christ, why in the world would meeting non-humans that didn't affect their relationship to the cosmos.
Well, because, Linda, to them, the word is the word. There is but one God, period.
And others not believing in that God shouldn't have any impact on them.
And yet that's what they said. I mean, this is a major...
Yeah.
It's okay at 1,480 light years. People go, okay, you know. But
it makes it safe.
Yes, it makes it safe.
It is a discovery at a safe distance.
There you have it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you have any guesses which way this is going to go, Linda?
Well, you know, that is a very appropriate question. And I... like Jason Wright when he said, wow, that would be cool. I guess I want it to be structure of something that is, of course, advanced, intelligent, compassionate, benign, and that we will be introduced to other life in the universe in the best, most positive way that there can possibly be, and that is a sort of fantasy answer. The other part that is being more realistic is that we may go on for a year or so with all of these efforts to try to analyze the light signatures and trying to determine if there's any dust and all of that. It may take much longer than we think that we're going to get an answer. And in the meantime, what I've found frustrating, like in series, it's sort of parallel. That we get something that is discovery. Last time I was on Midnight into the Desert, we were talking about Ceres. And this is, to me, sort of parallel of what kind of a world are we in now when science seems to become so political so rapidly and gets then manipulated, and that comes down to this.
Well, we're in the world of our own making.
Well, the fact that science is becoming so political is disturbing, and this is worth reporting tonight. We left off, you and I, about the excitement of the discoveries on Pluto and Ceres, and that in Ceres were the intriguing bright spots in that crater called Akator.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's a crater, it's about 60 miles across, 2 miles deep, and in this was I think it's fair to say, a kind of pattern of very bright lights that seem to be self-glowing even in the images when the dawn was going, the planet or the planetoid was rotating, and you could still see some of the light at the horizon edges. And Christopher Russell, Ph.D., at UCLA. He's been Don's mission principal investigator right from the beginning. He's a very, very respected planetary geophysicist. Well, he said that to me back in what would have been the July going into August period, he said, quote, we're getting data from the VIR spectrometer, and I got a report back yesterday, and this was the end of August, that all of the data over the bright spot was obtained, but the white substance is still unidentified. Close quote. I have this on the recording. So he had told me that when we got down to 930 miles above the surface, that should be happening in the 1st of August, and to call him and we would do another interview.
Right.
And he was delightful to talk with, and he and I share this love of astronomy and planets, and we really bonded, and he said, I would really like to do another interview with you, and I called him. And he said on the phone, Linda, we've run into a problem.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we have lovely, that was his word, we have lovely new photographs from this new orbit that has settled into about the 915, 930 miles above Ceres. But he said, one of our scientists has submitted a paper to Nature. Nature is UK, remember?
Sure.
Not US, it's
right.
UK.
Right.
It's American tax dollars that are paid for this Dawn mission, but it is the UK Nature that has now embargoed all of the new photos from the 915 to 930 miles. And this is an interview that I did with Professor Christopher Russell, and everybody listening can go to my September 3rd Earth Files and read part one. Where are new images of the bright spots on Ceres from the lower 915 mile orbit? And I say the NASA Dawn spacecraft is in its new lower mapping orbit of 915 miles above the dwarf planet's surface, but an embargo by the journal Nature is preventing the release of new images taken closer to the
octopus. Wait a minute, Linda, wait a minute. How can a British publication, how can they embargo pictures that the American taxpayers have paid for?
That's my question. It was my question to Professor Russell. He seemed himself to be frustrated, and here is the kicker. This was two full months ago, because you and I are talking now on November 3rd. I did this Earth Files report on that last discussion with Professor Russell about the fact that he couldn't release photos because they were embargoed on September 3rd, 2015. He said to me when we left off the phone discussion about the new photos and some of the things that they were seeing in the new photos, which he couldn't release, he said, look, I agree with you. I'm going to go to Nature and to the scientists and see if we can't work out some sort of a compromise here, because you're right, Linda. This is an American project, and we should be able to all of us share in these photos. And he said those words. And the next day...
Linda. I've got a question. Who the hell made a deal with them in the first place that allows them, under any condition, to embargo?
That's what I'd like to know. It is, and he didn't have an answer beyond the fact that the paper had been submitted to Nature, which automatically embargoed the release of the photos, and the entire paper was about what the bright spots in the Akator crater could be.
So what idiot signed that on our behalf?
I don't know. And it's now 2 full months later, and all you have to do is type in a URL, news about the Akator crater bright spots, and there's nothing. There's been no image releases. And this is very germane to the question you ask about Tabby Star 1,480 light years away. What if they decide, and when I'm talking about the powers that be that are trying to guide, restrict, and manipulate how this planet learns that we're not alone in the universe, what if the same thing, embargoes are put on new information that SETI and others might learn, and that they know for a fact that it were, let's say that they decide that it is intelligence, what if embargoes are put on it and they cover it up for X amount more time because they're saying that they need scientists to be able to publish? Do you see where I'm leading?
Yes,
We should be getting this news now, and not waiting for alleged Waiting for Godot publications. And the very fact that this has happened on Ceres, a dwarf planet out between Jupiter and Mars, when it got to 915, and we are now November 3rd, we're supposed to be only 4 weeks away from the spacecraft getting down to 235 miles above the surface. And Professor Russell himself told me, he said, we should be able to identify everything. But then this was another one of the surprises. He said, one of the problems we have is with our camera. The pixels will only go down to something like, I'm trying to remember now if it was 3,100 feet or 3,100 miles. It was like pixelation that was not fine and resolution enough. If these were, like if there were tiny buildings, we might not be able to see them from 235 miles. And he was saying it was because they didn't have enough money when they put the Dawn spacecraft together to have a good camera with high resolution. And you just go, what? How could we do this and go out all that way? And the one thing that we need more than anything else is clear, high-resolution pictures of the surfaces of these things. Is it possible that that is true? Or is that a kind of another deflection that, depending upon what they find, they can always say, well, the resolution isn't high enough to see if there are buildings?
Or, Linda, is it possible that the higher resolution photograph simply, for reasons that we can only imagine, are being withheld from us?
Well, it's a very good question. And right now, anybody can do this themselves. Google for a new images of Ceres from the 915, and it's settling down. It's going to be going to 235 in December, which is not very long. And if they haven't released photos since we were at 1270, remember?
Yes.
And we should have all the close-ups available to the whole world in December. And we haven't even gotten them from 915. And then that we're talking about the bright spots in the Achator crater. What about that amazing 4 mile high mountain that looks like it's made out of glass,
right,
with all those parallel lines going down it? And what's sitting right next to that 4 mile high mountain is that big crater right next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And even Professor Russell said that when he first saw it, he wondered if there was some relationship between the mountain and that crater. Well, maybe the 915 or the 235 orbit might tell us more. And right now, we don't have anything that is closer than the last more distant mapping orbit. So you see, this is very peculiar. This is very peculiar because even if they were tying up with an embargo on the Achator crater with the strange bright spots, why wouldn't we have all kinds of images on this 4 mile high mountain and that crater?
Linda, do you think it has to do with money? In other words, are they somehow giving this information to nature or whoever they're giving it to because a financial deal of some sort has been cut? Now, it doesn't make any sense that such thing would have been done, but you know what they say, always follow the money.
Well, here's a direct quote from Professor Russell to my question about how it is possible that the UK Journal could do this. And he said, we were just ready to submit with a press release. This is him talking to me back at the end of August, going in the first week of September. We were just ready to submit with a press release written, and the new images of the bright spots were in our press release, and then we realized that one of the investigators had sent in a paper to the publication Nature, which required an embargo for us not to talk before publication, and the paper is about the bright spots, making an interpretation of what the bright spots are. And I said, what is the embargo date? And he said, well, you know, the trouble with getting involved with these journals, the paper has been sent out for review, but it has not been accepted. So we're in this never-never land of not knowing. But the new photos are lovely, quote, unquote.
Oh, yeah, thanks for that.
So
nice.
This is very strange.
Well, again, who is the idiot who signed such a thing? I mean, was that just an error, or is there money involved?
Well, you know, another interesting thing that he told me from the photos that he said that he had right there on his desk, he said, it looks like there's a fairly thick dusting of white powder. It covers the area nicely and smoothly, and it goes up and down over the terrain.
Huh.
So something has been puffing out white powder in the region probably for some time, and that this is probably a fairly thick layer of this white powder covering the region that we call the bright spot.
Can he say all that without violating whatever stupid agreement there is?
I don't know, but see, that what is so interesting is that I read to you that quote, that we're now getting data back from the VIR spectrometer, And I got the report back yesterday that all of the data over the bright spot was obtained, but the white substance is still unidentified, close quote. Mm-hmm. So if they've got close-up spectroscopy at that 915 level, and they still can't identify what this white stuff is, that's a fantastic mystery.
Sure. Of course it is. And the British have it locked up.
That's what's so strange, weird, and unfair. And that's why I raised this, because what if we are now at a time when we're going to have one unbelievable astronomical discovery after another, but all of the release to the public can be controlled by alleged embargoes by journals?
You know, what you've said is so outlandish that I actually don't know how to react, except with anger.
Well, it is frustrating. I must say, I was looking forward, so looking forward, that we were all having this wonderful effort in the dawn. It felt like, didn't it, in the beginning, oh, my God, look at what we're discovering, and it's all together, and everybody in the world is seeing everything at the same time, and the astronomers are baffled, and, oh, this is so exciting. And then suddenly it becomes just as political as everything else.
Okay, so, you know, maybe we ought to urge people to write to their representative and raise holy hell. And somebody ought to be sitting in front of a congressional committee going, I can't recall, or something. I mean, we've got to get somebody to answer for this.
Yeah, saying, why don't we have the series photos in front of us now?
And why is a British publication able to embargo very important information that the U.S. taxpayers paid to get?
Yeah, that's it. That's the bottom line.
Damn.
So anybody listening, if you can get in touch with, I don't exactly know who to reach out to, because what is the leverage point from Americans to nature if they can, in fact, embargo material that is related to American a space mission?
Well, and a lot of people in America subscribe to nature. There is that.
Well, ask.
you know, what I mean is if people threaten not to buy Nature anymore, the publication, then they might think that over.
Well, it is such a brilliant journal. It really is. But it is showing a face here of manipulation and control of information germane to us that I didn't think was possible.
I would not have said this would be possible either. You know, in the past, there have been sort of deals like this that I've heard of. You know, people who process some of the early images of Mars. I remember some kind of strange stuff about that too, even the moon, and they were held back for certain reasons and deals that were made. But now with a British publication, my goodness.
Exactly. So it is and this, I hope people listening will be even more curious, perhaps write even more letters to NASA and to Nature about, are we going to be able to see all of the photographs at the next low orbit at 235 miles above Ceres? And if not, why not? Because the last words we had from scientists was they would get into that orbit, and that this spacecraft would stay in that orbit, and that they would be getting back information for as long as those little jets would keep going with their ionization. And right now, we've had a block from September through October on the 915 images. So what is going to happen in December?
I don't know. Maybe NASA's getting so starved for funding, Linda, that they're beginning to, sell to the highest bidder.
Wow.
I'm not really serious about that. I'm sure that will not be taken well at NASA. But, I mean, I do know these deals are made, but for it to be made with a foreign journal, even the prestigious Nature, and it is prestigious, and then having embargoes slammed on. Ay-yi-yi, in this day and age.
It's not fair. It's just not fair. And it's time that we all can participate with complete freedom of information about things in our own solar system.
Hear, hear. All right. So we've done pretty well in covering Tabby so far. And
right, and our solar system, and we could come back to Earth to talk about what's happening in the North Atlantic.
I would like to do that. Are we talking? Well, all, you know what I want to talk about? I want to talk about this cold blob, and I guess that's in the Atlantic, right?
Yeah, and listen, do you remember? It goes back to December 2002, and that's when I did my very first Dreamland post with you
right.
about what then we were calling it the North Atlantic Oscillation,
uh-huh.
and I was doing an Earth Files report and a coast and a Dreamland with you because there was data then that was suggesting that that big conveyor belt that takes the warm Gulf Mexico water northward
yes.
into the North Atlantic, where it has to be salty for the cold water to sink.
Uh-huh.
It's the sinking of the salt density that keeps that big conveyor belt going and drawing that warm water. And back in 2002 were the first rumblings that there was data beginning to say that it was slowing, and that's where you and I were on the air talking about it then. And, in fact, it was the journal Science had published findings that there were, I think it was six, world biggest freshwater rivers in Eurasia. And they were dumping all of this freshwater into the Arctic Ocean because this was the beginning of all the permafrost melting of fresh water, and that was diluting the salt.
All right. Hold it right there, Linda. And the possibilities then are terrible. You begin to disrupt those currents, and Europe could freeze up. Somebody wrote a book about that. It became The Day After Tomorrow, right?
I hear the drums echoing tonight. She hears only whispers of some quiet conversation. She's coming in from that fight. The moonlit wings reflect the stars that guide the moon.
To initiate a dialogue sequence with Art Bell, please coordinate your phalanges and call 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
Well, okay. Linda Moulton Howe is my guest, and we're about to talk about the blob. Now, that makes a good headline, right? Blob. Sounds like a science fiction movie from, I don't know, maybe the 50s. The blob. This blob isn't, actually, it's a lot scarier than that old blob movie. So here's the deal. The blob is a very disturbing mass of very cold water. And one thing, let me read this. Americans are hot, but not too bothered by global warming. Most Americans know our climate is changing, but they say, well, you know, they're just not worried about it. Now, this is according not just to my observation, but a poll by the Associated Press and the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. So, that brought on my comment at the beginning of the show that until the water is lapping at the ankles of Americans, they're not going to do a damn thing about what's going on with the climate. They're just not worried about it. That's all there is to it. It's not going to be discussed. It's not up for discussion. They're not going to worry about it. Yeah, it's changing. They don't care. How about that, Linda?
Well, I'll tell you, in October of 2015, if there were six big rivers when you and I talked about this back in 2002 that were dumping fresh water into the North Atlantic and they were getting slower conveyor belt, then right now even more fresh water is melting off of Greenland into the North Atlantic. And this clearly, I mean, there's no question that all of the ice melt coming off of Greenland is going to dilute the salt density in that water. The question is, to what extent and how long will it take to have impact? And this is when just 2 weeks ago I talked with Thomas Delworth, PhD. He's a research scientist with NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab. And he's professor of atmospheric and ocean sciences program at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. And well-respected, tremendous substance in his knowledge about this, what is called the scientists today, instead of North Atlantic Oscillation. They refer to this as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, A-M-O-C is the acronym. And
as in running amok, but not quite.
Right. Absolutely. And what makes this extremely interesting and unusual and disturbing is that for 2 years and 2 years only, they started measuring really abnormally cold. We're not talking about just a little bit cold. We're talking about really abnormal, off the charts. They're calling them record-breaking cold temperatures in the North Atlantic, and it keeps growing. It is growing and growing, and that's what they're referring to as this abnormally cold blob. But when I went to Professor Delworth to ask him about it, he said it is absolutely true that the amount of melting is increasing over Greenland and that somehow much of that could be leading to this abnormal cooling in the Atlantic. But here's the problem. They can't get data that will explain to them why there is a two-year-long growing, expanding, gigantic amount of this cold water when it does not appear to be that the Greenland, and this is now something, imagine everybody who is listening, put your mind down to Florida, off the coast there and the Gulf, and know that we get up into the high 80s in the summer. That gets to be really hot water.
Sure.
And it is going in gigantic currents up into that North Atlantic, and the expectation would be that there is so much hot water and it is such volume, it would have an impact on the North Atlantic, and that this gigantic, expanding, growing area would not be able to keep doing this without having some tempering from this hot water. So now, the very fact that it has expanded for 2 years is a mystery, but it has led to other research having to do with winds. And the more I have been interviewing scientists in the last 2 or 3 years, the more I'm beginning to understand that the relationship between what is happening with bands of winds as the planet is warming up is becoming a really serious consideration, not only in the northern hemisphere, but the southern hemisphere, and we'll talk about Antarctica here in a few minutes. But what he said to me, a direct quote, "We've seen in the last 2 years stronger than usual winds over the North Atlantic, over that entire region. Those could actually be cooling the ocean directly by the atmosphere. And the winds are not only increasing in intensity, they've been changing where their bands are." And that is something that is playing into scientific analysis of what has been happening in Antarctica. I saw earlier tonight on CNN and on Fox, they had running across on the bottom headline, scientists say ice buildup in Antarctica. Well, I talked about that with Professor Delworth as well, and he said that it is these bands, are these bands of winds that have been moving toward the South Pole, that what they have found is that the temperatures are so cold and the winds are so strong that where ice is coming off of Antarctica and falling into the water, instead of moving north in circulation and melting as would be expected, the winds are forcing all of this breaking ice to stay around Antarctica, and the temperatures are going colder. And in fact, October 6th, a little less than a month ago, NASA reported that when Antarctica ice grew to its annual peak on October 6, 2015, this year's maximum ice fell much lower, to roughly the middle of the amount that had been measured during the past 37 years of satellite observations. Not increased, it was lower. And that scientists speculate that it is possible that the spreading warm El Nino in the Pacific has dampened Antarctic ice buildup, but that the hemispheric winds are so much stronger than they used to be because of a warming atmosphere, and that one consequence is that sea ice that melts and breaks off of Antarctica clusters around the continent instead of floating northward and melting, which is exactly what Professor Delworth told me was his analysis, and this came out officially what I just read to you from NOAA. So we have climate warming, global climate warming. We have a mist North Atlantic having to do with the cold blob there, and then we have the what you might call paradoxical data that there is Antarctic buildup of ice, but that it may very well be related to the winds there that are cooling everything down and keeping the ice from spreading. And it may be both in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere that the changes in intensity and bands of winds are causing more impact than anybody had ever seen in computer models.
All right. Well, you just explained something that was very interesting, and I don't know that I got it. In other words, you're right. There is a story saying that there is now more Antarctic ice than ever before, not less. And so you're telling me, no, that's wrong. There is less. Is that correct?
Yeah, they had a measurement in October, on October 6th, and this was NASA from satellites, saying that the annual peak of Antarctic ice was much less than it had been last year or the year before. In fact, that it measured at about the middle amount of buildup that they have seen on average over the last 37 years. But bigger than that is that the paradox of hearing about more ice in Antarctica could very well be tied to these strange increasing intensities of wind bands that are moving toward the South Pole, and they're going to increase snowfall from more moisture that's being carried in warmer atmosphere, but the winds are also pushing against any ice getting north. And so you've got two things at work. You've got brute force of winds holding the ice that falls off of Greenland, and then you've got the colder temperature from the intensity of the winds creating more snowfall, all of it related to global warming.
All right, so what happens if all that ice that's being held there by the winds you're talking about suddenly somehow gets set free?
It's a good question, because if you jump back up to the North Atlantic, the more ice comes off of Greenland into the North Atlantic, it's fresh. It's
right.
Fresh water.
That's right, yes.
And it is going to dilute that salty water. And at least Professor Delworth, he's not dismissive about anything, but he says that the computer models, have been some headlines that Western Europe could end up facing much colder winters.
Oh, yes.
Do you think that's possible? And he said, there's very little evidence to support that. The idea that this weakening or collapsing AMOC will cause severe cold over Western Europe is just not supported by the science. He goes into the computer models, which he does a great deal of computer modeling, and they see that there definitely could be a slowing of the conveyor belt, but that it will be gradual, and that the positive upside to all of this is that if the conveyor belt were going to be allowing colder temperatures in the western Europe and along the east coast of the United States, while we know that water temperatures from the Gulf and the South are getting warmer and warmer and warmer every summer, that we might end up with one of those, by the grace of God, we've got warmer waters that are meeting with colder waters, and it's gradually slowing the conveyor belt, but nothing catastrophic, and that, in fact, all of this warm water would help temper what would happen to Europe if the conveyor belt gets slower. So we are on right now the most complicated planet. In every direction, there are contradictions and paradoxes because global warming is producing way more water in the atmosphere, and that water has to come out. But at the same time as warmer air gathers more water, it also denies waterfalls in lots of areas of the planet. That's why computer modeling for getting to 400 parts per million CO2 and beyond, and we hit 402, we hit 400, I think, or 402 just a year ago,
right.
And that the computer models have always shown there will be huge droughts and there will be huge flooding events because the it's called adiabatic warming and cooling. When you have these...
You know what, though, Linda? I've got to go back to this because it's really important. If the American people don't care about climate change enough to do anything about it, and that is what this study says, imagine how little they care just in case any of those ocean currents are in trouble or potentially could be in trouble. The answer is minus 10.
Well, I'll tell you something that is already happening, and this is coming from people who communicate to me at earthfiles.com about where they are living in Florida and North Carolina and South Carolina. And these are direct letters saying that even now, when there is a full moon, they can have flooding in their sidewalks and streets, the ones that are very close to sea level.
Right.
And that these are coming from people who have lived there for a very long time. They've never seen this before. And I also know from a person who does not want their name to be used or their title, they are working inside of Florida government. And they said the biggest secret is that there have been all kinds of meetings with the governor on what are they going to do because they are getting flooding. They're getting lots of flooding for all kinds of events and reasons that they didn't have before. And if, remember James Hansen, he got together, I think it was 16 scientists, and they released, it wasn't very long ago, and it was about the fact, in fact, I have it right here, it was NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies is where he has been, and he now directs the Program on Climate Science Awareness and Solutions at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He and 16 other prominent climate researchers collaborated on a July 2015 paper in which, this is James Hansen with them, said, quote, if the ocean continues to accumulate heat and increase melting of marine terminating ice shelves of Antarctica and Greenland, a point will be reached at which it is impossible to avoid large-scale ice sheet disintegration with sea level rise of at least several meters, close quote. And that was one of the headlines in the New York Times back in July when they released that paper. And Hansen said that he thought now conservatively that by New Year's Day 2100 that there could have been a 12-foot rise in sea level. Well, that would take out at least half of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not...
I would like to repeat to you, Linda, there's study after study. The American people don't care. Now, I grant you, when the seawater, or actually seawater with not as much salinity as was there previously, begins to lap at their ankles, they might care, but not until then, guaranteed.
Well, this is now, we're in a laboratory test, Art. We're in a living laboratory test.
Yeah, yeah,
if the planet is changing and islands are going to go under,
well, yes,
and people are going to have to be moved, and animals are dying and trees are dying, and that somewhere along the line, maybe there will be that real tipping point where it is rubbed so hard in our faces that people will act, or it's going to be that there will be so many catastrophes that governments can no longer pay for that it will force Earth and civilizations back to a new level of energy use, consumption, and emission.
Well, I guess if there are really big emergencies, if we get nothing but Category 5 after Category 5, and it's moving that way now, actually, Linda. We're getting an awful lot of Category 5s. You, of course, watched that massive hurricane that made itself a Category 5 virtually overnight and then dissipated just about as quick, right?
Yeah, the intensity that brought that to the 5 category, and then the release of the energy is part of what they call this hugely dynamic, where everything is going to be more dynamic. Professor Delwar said exactly the same thing when I said, what is it that you most expect will be outstanding in the rest of the 85 years of this century? And he said it will be the increasing intensity in storms that the computer models show, that the storms will become increasingly violent, but the good side is there may be fewer storms. They don't fully understand why the computer models show that, but that is what they show. Great intensity, fewer intense storms.
Interesting. All right. Well, yeah. If you were living in the Philippines, you wouldn't know that this year, that's for sure. Listen, Linda, would you be up to answering some listener questions? You've laid out an awful lot of material tonight, right?
Yeah.
All right, good. Hold it right there then. We've got a break coming up, and when we get back from it, I will lay out, well, I'll do the talk, actually. And so if you want to speak to Linda Moulton Howe about something she has said, now is the time to begin thinking about it. Boy, she has really laid out some serious material tonight. No question about that. I'm Art Bell. Midnight in the desert, scorching across the land.
I can see her lying back in her satin dress, in a room where you do what you don't confess. Someday when you better take care of that, I ain't gonna be creeping around.
And if you don't love me now, you'll never love me again.
Midnight in the Desert spans the world. To call us from outside the U.S. and Canada only, use Skype with a headset mic if on a computer, and call MITD55. That's MITD55.
All right, so here's a talk, short version, mind you. Our public number to reach Linda, area code 952-225-5278. One more time. Area code 952-225-5278. Skype. We love Skype because it sounds so good. Now, you can download Skype to your whatever, your phone, your iPad, whatever. It's free. Skype is free. And it's pretty cool because, A, it lets you sound better, and, B, you can make free calls from anywhere in the world. Absolutely free. So when you get Skype, put it on your device, become familiar with it, and then when you're a little familiar with it, you'll see a plus sign up there, and that's called Add a Contact. Push it. And then add us. In the case of North America, MITD51. as in midnight in the desert. Case doesn't matter. Just the letters, MITD51. If you're in the rest of the world, somewhere else in the world, it's MITD55. That's MITD55. That's the way to reach us, and that's the way to ask a question if you would like to. There is just one more thing I would like to ask Linda about, and that is actually two questions. One, it seems to me that there are fewer what I would call legitimate UFO sightings in fairly recent years than there have been in the last, 50 years, 45 and on. It got pretty hot, 47, whatever. It got pretty hot. A lot of sightings everywhere. Not so much in recent years, it seems to me, although I know Linda knows of one in Georgia, and if we can do a very short summary of that, I'd love it.
Well, I will try. It is one heck of a story, and from my Earth Files news point of view, I would say that there has been increasing numbers of substantive UFO experiences, encounters, people in the human abduction syndrome.
Oh, yes.
Yes, the high strangeness has increased from where I sit. And in this particular case, we're going back to June 28th, 2015, starting a little bit after sunset in the Fort Hunter area in Georgia near Savannah. A sergeant who has asked for anonymity, so I call him CJ, his wife, two children, a dog, and a cat, set off in a truck for a move from Fort Hunter going to Colorado Springs, Colorado, for him to do new work at Fort Carson. And their choice was to travel at night, cooler for the animals and the kids, not as many trucks and cars on the road, and so they would sleep in the day and go at night. And the plan was, with his brand new GPS, not a man unfamiliar at all with GPS, he's been in the Army for a long time, he has part of his work is to be able to identify things that are in the sky, what type they are, engines, everything.
Okay.
So he's an observer. He got a brand new GPS, programs it, final destination, Colorado Springs, Colorado, and the route will be through Atlanta, 4.5 hours from the Hunter Army Airfield region outside of Savannah to Atlanta. They should be there at midnight. Something bizarre happened at about 112 miles into their journey, and neither the wife nor the husband knew that this occurred, that the GPS took them off on a route that went almost 90 degrees to the north when they are, or northeast, when they were going essentially what would be northwest to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up, when they become conscious of anything, it is of a light. And they end up pulling the truck over to the side of a road, not understanding where they are or what's happening, but they're seeing this bright white light, comes down in front of the truck. The Army sergeant estimates, based on all of his experience with looking at things aerial, that it's 820 feet wide, which is about 3 football fields, and that this has come down about 200 feet above the car. He thinks that the width, so if it's 820 feet wide, it's about 200 feet high. He and the wife are both looking at, they see different shapes, as often people do, but something coming around the middle that might have been lights in set windows, but it's right below that midline, that they see 5 dark symbols. And everything about the timeline seems jumbled. And when they, where they stopped and pulled over, they had just gone through thick fog. And there was no reason for there to be thick fog. It was a clear, beautiful night. there was nothing, no rain, but they remember very clearly, both of them.
Okay, so Linda, if I'm getting this correctly from you, this craft, you're thinking, misdirected them, took control of their GPS, and brought them where the craft wanted them to be.
To Wadley, Georgia, which is a really tiny town, and they he has only one solid thing that gives a timeline for all of this being in this truck with this huge thing, is it blinks out. It didn't travel. It just blinked out, and he looked at his watch, and his digital watch said 1:29 a.m., which would have been Eastern time. And he thinks, I think we were there for just 5 minutes, Linda, but he said, when it disappeared, my wife and I are completely confused, and I move the car forward, and not very long, we see a gas station, and I pull in, and I try to get out of the truck, and my legs feel like wet noodles. I don't know what is happening or what is wrong. My wife feels disoriented. The kids are asleep in the back, and they get something at this gas station, and then they are still following their GPS in the car. And he said, we are so disoriented that I'm still going toward where it says that the final destination is still ahead of us. And he said, we get in the car blindly, and we drive where the GPS then says we've reached the final destination. And it was a cemetery, empty, dark, in Wadley, Georgia. And at this point, his left brain begins to start clicking in. Something is really wrong. Why aren't we in Atlanta? What is how has this happened? And that's when he turns around, goes back now with sort of a disturbing alarm beginning to enter his consciousness about what in the hell has happened. And they get back on the road. They get to Atlanta 1 hour after sunrise, and they check into a motel. He begins to have nightmares and can't sleep, and they're all upset, the husband and the wife, and they finally get back on the road again. It's the next night, the night of June 30th, where all of this dovetails into something reminiscent of Jim Peniston at R.A.F. Bentwaters in Rendlesham Forest 36 years before. They drive, and then they try to get some sleep because they are exhausted and beginning to feel sick. And so now they check into a Motel 6. The Motel 6 gives them an 8.5 by 11 type receipt. And why this is relevant, when he went to bed the second night, he's seeing gray beings, nightmares, all sorts of things are coming jumbling into his mind. Mm. And as far as he's concerned, he was sleeping, seeing these beings. And then it would be just like you open your eyes and you can't believe. You're standing in the motel bathroom. You have the receipt from the Motel 6 in your left hand. You have a ballpoint pen in your right hand. And you are looking at the back of the 8.5 by 11, and here are squares and lines filling the entire back of this receipt. And you have telepathic words that are coming into your mind. And at that moment, as he thinks he's gone nuts. He doesn't understand what is happening. And they continue from that point going forward, getting to Colorado Springs, with him having binary code coming into his mind, all sorts of bizarre things, and the grays are becoming more vivid in more and more dreams. Now, when I got in touch with him, he sent me, because I asked, I said, can I have the receipt starting from Hunter Airfield, you said you stopped and you got a bungee cord and some stuff. I would like to make sense, at least on paper, of all the receipts that you've still got from that trip so I can lay it out and try to understand.
Okay.
And in my Earth Files reports, all of these receipts at gas stations and the motel and the hotel and everything I do have and lay out. And you get to my asking him if I could send this these squares and ones to three different people who have worked with me on binary code and see what they would come up with.
Okay.
And at Earth Files, I have this whole story, and what is so interesting is that I did the same thing with binary code analyzing people on Jim Peniston from December 26, 1980, and I put a comparison in my Earth Files report. And I'm just, because we're compressing time, I'm going to give you the sentences first of what has come out from three very skilled binary code translators. They all agree. Here is the first line of the squares and lines in the Army sergeant who found himself becoming conscious mm-hmm. in the bathroom, having filled up the back of the receipt. Here's the first line. Continuous protection of humanity, latitude, longitude, 49.27 degrees north, 11 degrees, 5 minutes east. And when I went to Google
Earth, I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
Yep. 49.27 north.
Got it.
11.5 east. And I did this in Google Earth and could not believe that I was coming up in Hohenberg, Germany, about 100 miles northeast of Nuremberg. And I was thinking of course, Nuremberg was where the Nazi trials were held, but a friend of mine said, remember, Linda, that woodcut from 1561, it shows what appears to be what's called a UFO battle of different shaped craft in the sky around the sun and a great big black spear down below them. It is called the Hans Glaser woodcut from 1566, and it is a woodcut about an April 14th, 1561 battle over Nuremberg that was published in the Nuremberg Gazette of 1561. And this is what they said, that the morning sky was filled with cylindrical shapes from which emerged black, red, orange, and blue-white spheres that darted about. I'm reading from the Nuremberg Gazette. Between the spheres, there were crosses with the color of blood. This frightful spectacle was witnessed by numerous men and women. Afterwards, a black spear-like object appeared, and it goes on saying that prior to this morning of 1561 in April, where there appeared to be a war in the skies, that right before this, get this sentence, the sun and the moon have been darkened on a number of occasions in the preceding weeks and months, which makes no sense, but this is a 1561 report. Well, what if this sentence, continuous protection of humanity, and this puzzling latitude-longitude, which turns out to be Hohenberg, Germany, 100 miles northeast of Nuremberg, means that this is an area of Earth where there have been battles between the friendlies and the unfriendlies, as Lynn Buchanan would say from remote viewing,
mm-hmm.
and that there is something trying to actually protect humanity in a continuous, ongoing way. And now I'm going to go to the next sentences. We're now with the Georgia Army Sergeant. Expose hidden knowledge to all citizens, and all is all caps in the binary code. Expose hidden knowledge to all citizens. Next sentence, advancement imperative for planetary survival, and the interpretation is human advancement imperative, that we're too dumb and slow and behind and we've got to accelerate to survive. Then the next sentence, beware of Orion 1350.3 and the single letter cap Z, and then reticuli is spelled R-U-T-I-C-U-L-I, and followed by 39.1, question mark on the binary, 70. And the geneticist Horace Drew in Sydney, Australia, who did all of this translation that was backed up by the others, added this note. He said, those numbers, 1350.3 and 39.1 with a question mark and 70, they are actually the numbers of the distance in light years from Earth to the Orion Nebula, which is 1,350 light years, and to the binary star system of Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2, which is 39.17 light years. So he made that point. These numbers are not idle. They actually relate to light year distances.
Okay, here's what I don't get from all this, Linda.
Let's go to the final last sentence.
All right, go ahead.
Avoid signal messages sent. And he and I talked, the implication is the danger of sending out SETI signals without knowing who is on the other end, that I was talking about Tesla's Elon Musk, mm-hmm. Microsoft's Bill Gates, and Stephen Hawking worrying about. But just before you ask your question, because it's much shorter, Jim Tennyson, but listen to the words that are the same. We're jumping back 36 years. We're at December 26, 1980. Tennyson, his mind is filled with zeros and ones. When his fingers drag across mm-hmm. the raised symbols on the black or glassy triangle, we're at December 26, 1980, and I just finished sentences from June 29th, because it was after midnight of 2015. And you just heard that. Now, here is Tennyson. Exploration of humanity. The next word is origin, 8100. No one understands that. The next line is latitude and longitude, followed by the word continuous. The latitude and longitude may be town center of Woodbridge, Suffolk, England, or Ancient Aliens, Prometheus Productions. They interpreted the decimal point and put it out in the Atlantic Ocean at the mythical High Brazil. But it is another latitude-longitude, which is using the same communication, a sentence of words, and then followed by a latitude-longitude, the word continuous. The next line in Jim Tennyson is for planetary advance, and the last line is fourth coordinate time, is what the binary code people ask, fourth coordinate time, continuous, and the last word is before. Now, when you take the Tennyson zeros and ones and you compare it to the June 29th, you have these overlapping words having to do with continuous is used in both. Protection of humanity is inferred.
Yep, I get it.
Advancement imperative for planetary survival is in both. And that there is something about the binary code, whether you were in the crop formation in front of Chill Bolton, whether you were in Crabwood, whether you were exposed to the light and the symbols in Tennyson's case in Rendlesham Forest, or the strange diversion from the freeway that took them for this encounter with this craft. There is something out there that is communicating the same ideas. Avoid, we oppose deception. Mm. All humanity must know, humans must advance for planetary survival, and the very idea, exploration of humanity and protection of humanity amidst forces that may not be protective
okay.
of us.
All right, Linda, I get it all, and I've heard it actually several times, and I've heard it from multiple sources. Now, you've nailed it down, but really, Linda, if this critical message that you're describing is being delivered in various extremely obscure ways. I mean, extremely obscure. We're talking about something of planetary importance, right? And coming
why
from...
Why is it coming this way?
Yes, why in binary code and make it so obscure unless you're... You've got to accept the possibility that you're getting screwed with.
Well, the other option is, which is what people in the abduction syndrome have suggested, the governments took a position of policies of denial, which are policies of lies, and denying that there is any other intelligence in the universe in World War II, and that there have been human abductees who have indicated that they've had communications telepathically or other in symbols that had something to do with a frustration on the part of the non-humans feeling like that the government doesn't play straight with them, they may not be playing straight, and that humans are completely left out of this equation because it's all being handled by some sort of 1% of the planet, and that whatever the relationship is between the 1% controllers of Earth now and whatever all these different intelligences are, as Lynn Buchanan says, it isn't just one, two, or three. There's a lot, and they have different agendas and mixed motives. It could be that the non-humans think that the only way to communicate without them perhaps being hurt is to try to do it one-on-one with people through their minds. I don't know. It's just, it is all so peculiar. And if we didn't share information like this and the Peniston binary code and the crop circle code because it seems so strange, it seems so far-fetched, then we would be, I think, doing the same thing that the governments do. We would be cutting out some form of information that might actually be very valuable to humans.
I agree. I agree with that. It doesn't make common sense the way they're...
That's right.
It's so obscure, it just doesn't make sense. Very quickly, look, I've got to let some people talk to you, Linda. So,
yeah.
Richard on Skype has been very patient. Richard?
Good evening, Art. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Do you have a question?
Yes. Linda, pleasure to talk to you and Mega Roswells. The information that we're getting through the binary code, is that telepathic?
Well, you have to assume that what went into Peniston's mind that wouldn't leave his mind, if you've heard him, he was so frustrated that zeros and ones were in his mind's eye, like out in a screen in front of him, and there wasn't anything he could do to get them out from under, like they were just frozen there until he finally had what he thought was a telepathic thought to sit down and write them down. And that's where he put them in the back of the famous notebook, and none of us knew anything about his binary code until we were producing with the Ancient Aliens group. It was John Burroughs, Peniston, and me in Phoenix in fall of 2010 before we went to England all together for the 30th anniversary of the RAF Bentwaters, and that is when Peniston for the very first time showed any of us the zeros and ones, and John Burroughs was shocked that Peniston had not shown them to him in England. But Peniston said...
You got to admit, Linda, it came late.
Well, oh, yeah. But Peniston said, I just wondered if it was worth trying to see if anybody can figure out what this means, which is what set us off on getting binary translators. And remember that he has a description of the zeros and ones,
right,
being very vivid and not being able to leave his mind. That is not something that humans know.
Right.
Now,
right,
jump to the sergeant guy. He woke up, became beta conscious, having written down the zeros and ones. The corollary is that he had been seeing these squares and ones in the first dreams after the first night and had not written them down.
All right.
So somebody has the ability to put this kind of information in human minds and keep it there for reasons unknown until it is written down.
Richard, anything else?
Yes, just one more quick follow-up, and I'm calling you from Valdosta, Georgia today.
Okay.
Linda, what is the meaning and the possible correlation of the Georgia Guidestones to what's going on?
Well, I've been there. I was struck by the different, I think it's 8 different languages all saying the same thing, which is that the Earth's population must be reduced, whoever was behind setting those up, it's like a kind of Stonehenge with the same wording in the 8 languages going around the faces of those stones. And it's my understanding that the man who paid for the whole thing to somebody who was a miner of granite and did all of this disappeared. The tall man disappeared, and no one really knows who it was. So was it an extraterrestrial putting again another message in stone in such an esoteric, secret way? And I agree with you guys. It's very bizarre. The entire 5,000 years of civilization is bizarre because there are so many evidences of something not human interacting with and controlling and manipulating humans.
All right. We've got such little time. Daniel, if you're there, overseas somewhere, right?
Yeah, hi, Alan.
Where are you,
I'm calling you from a very drizzly London at the moment.
I can hear rain falling.
That's my umbrella. Just a quick one.
Very quick.
Guys, very quick. If you're first-time listener, subscribe. Also, Linda. I'm a great lover of the What Do They Know website, the UK's Freedom of Information.
Very quick,
just regarding a rendition forest, what you kind of expecting to see out of the upcoming releases from the Ministry of Defense over there.
All right. Hold on till after the break. Linda, hold on. We're out of break. I have no choice. This is where we have to break. All right. This is Midnight in the Desert, moving along and unstoppable in the night.
Feel free to sniff our packets. Then, with a smile on your face, please call the show at 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
Well, okay. I want to say this, and because I need to get it out. If the American people, if the world's people, are not willing to listen to well-educated, very, very well-educated scientists who are explaining that our climate is deteriorating before our very eyes, ice is melting, salinity is becoming less saline, we're in danger of having water inundate our major cities and cover them up. If the American people don't care about the changing climate, then to me it seems that an alien race who would be warning us of great danger or the history of their fight above our atmosphere, whatever the case may be, and doing so with a binary code brought late to the table with regard to Rendlesham, and now on the back of a Motel 6 receipt and more, is just, I'm sorry, but I just cannot buy it as a reasonable way to communicate with anybody. It's just absolute insanity to me. And it may all tie in very neatly, but the method is so ridiculous. If we want to attribute it to an advanced civilization, then they've got to find a better way to get this message through to us. That's all I can say. Linda, I'm sorry, but it just seems crazy.
I completely agree with you that it has... if you go back through the entire evolution of starting with Betty and Barney Hill up to today,
right,
that the communications with humans by the various types of non-humans have always been so bizarre. There have been theatrical productions that humans have found, as if the ETs were doing some kind of a holographic production with telepathic communication and symbols going into their heads. Mm. The symbols, something about symbols and binary code, have been linked for a very long time. The idea of touching symbols and getting downloads has been a part of the fabric. And so whatever we're dealing with, it does not interact with humans in a human way, that is for sure.
Okay.
If we are dealing with androids that are programmed to do a specific kind of work on this planet, and we're not dealing with the prime intelligence that made them, it may be that there's something cumbersome about always having the androids trying to deal with the humans. I don't have the answers, but I really think it is important to pay attention to some of these cases where people are not trying to sell anything.
Mm-hmm.
They really are anguished about what has happened. And when you get down into these kinds of binary depths, whether it's Penison or Sergeant CJ or others, and you start seeing these same kinds of communication, you could say, why would there even be these same words or these same lines coming up over 35 years or 50 years?
I'm willing to ask that question why. We've got a guy standing in the rain in London, Linda, so let's let him.
Yes, and he asked the question about the 18 withheld UFO, UAP-related files by the MOD. And
right.
It started with work by John Burroughs, and they finally admitted to John in September of 2014 that in spite of all of the big show in 2011 that the MOD had released all of their UFO files to the National Archive, they didn't, and we knew it, but now they have admitted it. And right now, the 18, six of them, are policy files. They are labeled as policy files. John thinks there's a possibility that if we actually could get access to those files, it might be very, very important material. But in quoting him from an interview I did when he has been getting these admissions, he said that, do I think at the end of the day in September of 2015, and now the MOD has extended from 2015 September to the end, possibly the spring or the end of 2016. They pushed it back, the release on these 18 withheld files, even further. So John says, do I think at the end of the day in September 2015, next year, if they release this, it's going to tell us anything? Probably not. They're going to cover it up, and they are just going to blow it off. But you never know, if you keep the pressure on, what will they end up doing? Because I believe this pressure itself got them to release something they did not want out, which was Project Condyne and the admission on these files.
Okay, back to London. Daniel?
That's great. I mean, there was an update on, I believe,
I'm sorry, you broke up there. What?
Research data in January, I believe they disclosed. Yeah, they. I believe there was an update in January. They released an update saying there was, I think, 12 or so files still yet to be released, and they're still considered.
There's
doing it. What do you think is the next big disclosure that's coming up?
Okay.
KIC, artificial megastructure.
I can certainly go along with that. All right, let's try a phone call, shall we? Hi, you're on with Linda Howe.
Hi, how's it going? I have a question for Linda. There's you haven't touched on any of the cow mutilations tonight.
No, we haven't.
I mean, I was just. She's made a lot of information on cow mutilations, and I wanted to get an idea of what her theory would be about the government actually doing them and covering up with the UFO story, because they wanted to test the cattle for radiation that the cattle have been grazing on.
Well, it's a thought. We're very short on time. Linda, have you come to any conclusions?
I can give you the hard fact reason of why that is not even feasible. I have worked with so many veterinarian pathologists and the John Altshuler hematologist pathologist, and when you get report after report, number one, no hemoglobin in the capillaries around excisions. You can't pump out capillary blood. Has to have been taken in a molecular or atomic way. If you have talked with the veterinarians that I have, who sheriffs went to them privately and off the record and asked them to do necropsies, and there is no surgical excision in the body of a 2,000-pound bull, but when they open up the mutilated animal that has an ear, eye, tongue, jaw, flesh, genitals, and rectum poured out all bloodlessly, and they find that the internal heart is missing from inside the pericardium, but there's no clotted blood,
right,
or that the esophagus has been removed surgically and there's no blood, or every single organ in the what's called the mediastinum has been removed, which is the chest, and that was John Altshuler's firsthand experience in 1967 at the horse in southern Colorado, where the horse laid in an area of the desert where there were no hooves around that horse, with the it was stripped of flesh from the neck up, and all the organs had been removed from the professional doctors looking at it, and said they were removed professionally, and there was no blood, no clotted blood, there was no sign of blood. How would you take the internal organs out of the chest of a horse without having any signs of fluid? And Dr. Altshuler and so many others came to the conclusion that we are dealing with technology that is working at a molecular level, that it is able to cook hemoglobin, it is able to remove entire organs from within animal bodies without any surgery to the external body. And then you look at what law enforcement told me right from the beginning in 79. They had seen beams, they had seen discs, and when Sheriff Tex Graves sat across from me and looked me straight in the eyes in September of 1979 and said, "Linda, I'll save you some time. The perpetrators of animal mutilations are creatures from outer space." That has never changed. There have been at least 3,500 mutilations in Argentina since 2002. And the reports from veterinarians in necropsies have been the excisions have been cut with something that is heating the tissue.
Fair enough. Okay, so you're saying the government could not have done this, period.
No, they could not have done this. And no carbon at the excisions where there is cooked hemoglobin. We are carbon-based life forms.
Mm-hmm.
You take any kind of laser surgery to a human or to an animal, and you will be able to see carbon grains underneath in a microscope. In the mutilation excisions, there is no carbon residue. That has always been a big puzzle. What is the cutting instrument? No, it's extraterrestrials. And if it is a harvest of genes and genetic material, my guess now, today in 2015, is that a genetic harvest from this planet has been going on, I think, for hundreds of thousands of years. And it's been being applied to the creation of hybrids and clones,
mm-hmm,
and all kinds of things that serve some prime intelligences for reasons unknown.
All right. Bill on Skype very quickly with Linda. Hi.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Roswell's Art.
Thank you.
I can't believe I'm on, and I know I got to go quick. And I'm on an Android device.
Go ahead.
You know.
No, I don't know. Go ahead.
A doctor, I can't say his name, and Chukaku or whatever. He talks about a civilization 0-3.
Yes.
And when you had Stephen Greer on, he was talking about all the way to 10. I don't even know if that exists.
Nor do I.
But my point to this, and then I'll let her comment, and I do love you. I listened to you. I loved you at the citizens' hearing. I thought you made the best points, and I was just floored. But
okay,
anyway,
go ahead quickly. Your question, please.
If you go all the way to 10, that means we're just sentient beings, and there really is no life, no compassion. I don't know. But my point is how many are there in between? I mean, can't there be ones visiting us that are a two?
All right, Linda.
Lynn Buchanan, remote viewer. I have great respect for the work he did. He was working with Joe McMonagle and Mel Riley and Pat Price and all of those talented guys right on the NSA's property at Fort Meade in the 1980s. And Lynn Buchanan said when he had a task to do this remote viewing on extraterrestrials divided into these categories of psychic and non-psychic, friendly and unfriendly, he said, it isn't just four. There are hundreds and hundreds of types of non-humans, that the universe has lots of life in it, and that the puzzle, in many ways, is why is it from the Earth's perspective we are in a silent universe? Why is it not booming and buzzing to our instruments and to us? Why does it appear to be so silent when, in fact, to the remote viewers, it is filled with all kinds of intelligences, and that there are all kinds of mixed agendas, and that not everything is friendly, but that we do have allies that have been trying to protect humanity? Why does it have to be so behind the scenes? Why does it have to be so seemingly not straightforward? That is a big question. And on the government side, they chose a policy of denial, which was to officially lie, for 68 years now. And what I don't understand, and Jim Mars and a whole bunch of others, we are at a point on this planet where telling the truth about other life in the universe might actually be therapy for a lot of this planet. Mm. It might actually stop some of the tribal warfare. And why is it that we can't get on with it? I do not think that the vast majority of people are going to be running off cliffs like lemmings. I think the vast majority of people are already there, that we're not alone in the universe.
All right, very quickly, a question from Sean somewhere. Where are you, Sean? Hello, Sean. Going once. Going twice. Gone. Let's go to Michigan very quickly with Linda. Hi. Hello, Michigan.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello, this is Matt in Ann Arbor.
Yes.
I wonder if Ms. Howe has a theory as to what's behind the cattle mutilations.
Okay. Yeah, it's a genetic harvest, and it is a genetic harvest with an application that I think is applied to hybrid creation and rapid cycle cloning and a lot of things that would not be very comprehensible to humans, but it have been described to me by people who have had exposure in government and military work, and that I think it has been going on this planet perhaps millions of years, and that what we humans are going to finally realize and discover is that if it is civilization twos and ones out there that are moving through galaxies, and they have the ability because they've solved the energy problem and that they can move dimensionally, then what they need often must be planets like this one that are sort of like huge supermarkets mm-hmm. and gardens, and the relationship between us on this planet and some of those out there, as Jim Peniston said, that he got the telepathic download when he touched the symbols at Rendlesham mm-hmm. Forest and got the impression that this was a time machine, that what had sent it were 40,000 years in the future related to us, and they were coming back 40,000 years to gather genetic material to use as, quote, band-aids, close quote, in order to keep a civilization alive, buying time while they harvested genetic material from places in the past.
All right, Linda, we're running out of time. Show's ending. Have you been following Dr. Jacob's latest work?
Not really. I know that he has taken a very negative approach on the grays. I think Lynn Buchanan is more accurate, that it isn't even so much what they look like as that they can be a mixed bag, but it's that you can have something that looks the same, and some are friendly and some are not.
Well, Dr. Jacobs is now believing that we are actually being invaded by hybrids, a result of the genetic work that you were just talking about. We're out of time, Linda. We're out of time. Show's ending.
We'll have to do a show on just hybrids sometime.
Yes.
It's a huge story.
Yes, it is a huge story. You're right. Thank you very much, Linda. Bless
Thank
you.
Thank you, Art.
We'll do it again. Boy, we got a lot in this show. Good night.
Good night. God bless.
God bless. Good night, everybody. All 25 time zones. Oof. Let me get a word in very quickly. If you want to hear old shows, we got a lot of them. A lot of them. Become a time traveler. You do that by going to artbell.com. And you can download old shows. You can send messages on the computer. It's quite the deal. Time travelers at artbell.com. Good night, everybody.